Annie E. Casey Foundation.
Good morning. Welcome to Radioactivity. I'm Rob Loring. Coming up today, we're going to talk about the effort to make utility companies here in Florida be more energy efficient. We'll talk about that later in the program. First up today, there's a new effort to try to reduce drug prices in the U.S. The U.S. has some of the largest, highest drug prices in the world. There's a new coalition trying to lower those drug prices. The group says the only way to get drug prices down is to get government to take action. Today, they are holding a national day of action, and our guests are the coalition's director, Margarita George, and the American Medical Students Association president, Isaiah Cochran.
Congresswoman Rashida Tlaib.
Margarita George and Isaiah Cochran, welcome to WMNF. Good to have you here.
Thank you.
Good to be here.
So let me ask you about this coalition. You're trying to reduce drug prices in the U.S. What's the name of the coalition and who's involved in it?
The name of the coalition is Lower Drug Prices Now, and there's many groups involved in it, mostly groups who represent different constituencies. So there are labor unions, there are big online groups like Moms Rising and Move On. There's policy groups that do analysis and research on drug prices like Public Citizen and Oxfam and Roosevelt Institute. There's organizations that represent, that are networks of state organizations like the Center for Popular Democracy and People's Action. And there's constituency groups like the large Latino group Unidos U.S. and, of course, the American Medical Student Association. So there's about 30 groups involved right now, and we're anticipating that many more groups will get involved because this issue is just becoming such a huge issue across the board for people, really people of all ages in all geographies. And, you know, what we've seen is that when we go out and talk to people about this issue, folks pretty immediately ask us what they can do to get involved in the campaign.
And Isaiah Cochran, you're the president of the American Medical Student Association. Why did your group get involved in this?
Yes, so our group has a long history of being involved with many initiatives that help our patients achieve equal access to medicine and achieve health equity. So myself and Dr. Isaiah Cochran and Dr. Keenan McGonigal, our education and advocacy fellow for the year, actually have been doing some work in this realm and actually had the opportunity to meet with Nancy Pelosi earlier in the year on her bill advocating for and pushing for lower prescription drug pricing. So we get behind things like this all of the time. And one of the main things that AMHSA seeks to do is to empower physicians in training to stand up for their patients in the clinic, so to making sure that we are clinically competent, but also standing up for our patients outside of the clinic in regards to social justice matters, and this happens to be one of those matters that we feel very strongly about.
Isaiah, you're a doctor right now. You're practicing, aren't you?
So it's a weird situation that the AMHSA president is in, and usually our fellow as well. What happens is we finish medical school, and we serve as the president and our fellow, and we do so right after medical school because we are still, you know, we still have are in tune with our medical student members, and then we end up moving on to residency as the next step. So we have not started practicing yet, so we've just graduated medical school. So I like it because I'm still very much in tune with my medical student members, which is very important because we are the Medical Student Association.
And what I was getting at is, have you gone on rounds, have you worked in clinics, and have you seen firsthand the problems created by high drug prices in the U.S.?
Yes. So during third and fourth years of medical school, definitely saw it, and I am going into the field of family medicine. So I, as you can imagine, I did a lot of family medicine rotations my fourth year when we were able to more or less pick our schedule outside of a few things. And when I was on my rotations, I had the opportunity to work out in California. I went to med school in Dayton, Ohio, but I had the opportunity to rotation through UCSD, through their free clinic, and saw numerous people who were insured, as well as some uninsured people, but numerous people who were insured who could not afford their medications. And even more specifically, going back to where I attended med school in Dayton, Ohio, I had the opportunity to rotate with a mentor of mine, Dr. Rhea Rouser, and she had numerous patients who were at times, we had to and I hate to use the word fight, but we did have to, you know, we had to kind of do what we could in order to help our patients. And, you know, insulin is one drug, but insulin is not the only drug that our patients are not able to be covered able to pay for their medications. And I want to reiterate the fact that I'm talking about individuals who do have health insurance who are not able to pay for their medications. Obviously, we need to do better with our health insurance coverage for everybody, but I'm talking about folks who have health insurance who are still struggling to pay for medication.
So, Margarita, the cost of insulin is causing problems throughout the country where people are actually dying because of the high cost of insulin.
Yeah, absolutely. We just did a press event here in Washington, D.C., in front of the Capitol, where a woman just told a heart-wrenching story, a woman from Indiana, about she and her sister sharing insulin because they could only afford a dose, the right dosage for one person, and so they would split it. And the woman's sister ended up dying because she just skipped too many doses. So it's a really serious problem. We're seeing it all over the place. The broader issue of prescription drugs is the health crisis, right? 3 in 10 people in the United States report that they're not taking their medicine as it's been prescribed because of the cost, right? That means they're not filling their prescriptions, taking half doses or quarter doses. They may stop taking it, you know, altogether, or they take some other inappropriate alternative treatment because they can't afford what was prescribed to them. People with diabetes who are on insulin, you know, we're seeing research that's showing that a quarter of people with diabetes either skip doses or they take less insulin than they really need because they can't afford it. So it's a huge problem. And that story of the woman from Indiana really stuck with me because Indiana also happens to be the home of Eli Lilly, which is a large domestic producer of insulin. You know, Eli Lilly is, you know, just making money hand over fist. All the insulin has gone up tremendously. We've talked to people that were paying, you know, just $10 copay, you know, at the end of the year, and now they're spending hundreds of dollars a month on their insulin. So it's a huge, huge problem, especially in a country where we're seeing that this is one of the chronic diseases that's on the rise, is diabetes.
Margarita, if you were to compare drug prices in the U.S. to drug prices in other developed nations like Canada or the Scandinavian countries or Japan, how do our drug prices here compare to those prices in other countries?
Well, prescription drugs are more expensive in the United States than they are in any other comparable country. They're certainly more expensive than they are in Canada, but Canada's prices are still pretty high. When you compare prescription drug costs in the United States and Western European countries, even the poorer ones, right, Portugal, Spain, France, Germany, any of the Western European countries, prices here are often 3 to 4 times higher than what they are in other countries. And the main reason for that is, you know, prescription drug companies are pretty much allowed to set their own prices, and they're not required to negotiate those prices with government. Whereas in other countries, the prescription drug companies are required to negotiate those prices. And keep in mind that prescription drug manufacturers like Eli Lilly, for instance, they're not just American companies. They are worldwide companies. So the same insulin that is being sold abroad in other countries where the rate is negotiated between the company and government is much cheaper for counterparts in these other countries compared to here in the United States, where we might be paying 3, 4, even 5 times more for the exact same drug.
And is that the main reason that, for instance, Medicare and Medicaid are not allowed to negotiate lower drug prices with the big pharmaceutical companies?
Well, in Medicare, you know, Medicare has an explicit prohibition So it's actually legally prohibited for Medicare to negotiate drug prices with the prescription drug companies. That shouldn't be surprising because the part of Medicare that provides drugs for seniors, Part D, was actually negotiated by and written by the prescription drug industry. So they knew what they were doing when they together. It's a privatized system. There's no negotiation. It's prohibited by law. And there's no limit on out-of-pocket costs for prescription drugs in Medicare. In Medicaid, there is negotiation, just like there is in the Veterans Administration. The prescription drug companies negotiate to buy in bulk things like blood pressure medications and others. And so we see costs are a bit lower there. But whether you're talking Medicaid, Medicare, VA, or even private insurance, what we're seeing across the board is that prescription drug costs are driving an overall larger share of healthcare costs. And so that's exactly what Isaiah was saying earlier when he was talking about treating people who have insurance but still can't afford to get access to prescription drugs, because the cost of prescription drugs, the prices are just escalating faster. And that's not on accident. That's because the prescription drug companies can escalate those prices, and they can keep those prices really high through a system of patents and monopolies that prevent competition.
Isaiah Cochran with the American Medical Student Association. We're taping this on Monday. We're going to play this on August 20th. August 20th is a day of action for your coalition. What's going to happen on the 20th?
So let me kind of give you a framework of AMSA to kind of open up your eyes to who we work with and our membership. So we currently have over 30,000 medical students and pre-medical students. So a lot of what we do is, one, provide awareness and then calls to action. Our calls to action deal with working with local representatives as well as working with representatives in D.C. for those of us in the area, so Keenan and I. So our call to action, and I should say Keenan and I in schools in the area who have AMSA chapters, but our call to action is right now providing awareness and then moving forward for and gearing up for our advocacy day, which is in April, but we will be doing many things before then, but gearing up for our advocacy day where we really, really come together. So that's during our convention where we go on the Hill and advocate on many issues. So our call to action acutely for the 20th is utilizing our national leaders who work in our social media realms and outreaching to our chapters in regard to that, because our first step right now is making sure that all of our members are educated on what's going on, because I'm sure you can imagine a lot of members and a lot of medical students don't know much about what's going on, because we're not taught about this. You go through the first 2 years of medical school, you learn your basic sciences, and even third and fourth year, you're not taught about the issues. You see them firsthand, mm-hmm. and you go, oh my God, this doesn't make sense. So what our role in AMSA is, and I've always said, is to provide education for our medical student members that they don't necessarily learn in medical school. So that is what our call to action is tomorrow, is more so providing that awareness and then building on that throughout the rest of the year. Because as I stated, we really need to make sure that our medical students are, first of all, aware of what's going on, just like the general public.
Isaiah, we have a lot of medical schools in our area, several big ones. If somebody's listening and they're in medical school and they want to join the American Medical Student Association, what's the best way to do that?
So I'll do a little plug here. So I will actually be in Florida starting August 23rd for about 11 days. And I actually have had the wonderful opportunity to meet with many of the medical schools in the area, because I was down earlier this summer. So that includes University of Florida, University of Central Florida, and University of South Florida. And I will say that if you want to join AMSA, the first thing that you can do is check us out on AMSA.org. And for those of you that are using social media, you can follow us on Instagram at AMSA National. And beyond that, my contact information is provided on both of those outlets. And I would really love to speak with you, because while we all know in medical school it's very important for us to be clinically competent, it is just as important for us to be competent in regards to social matters surrounding our patients, because those matters are very important and will enable us to provide adequate care for all of our patients. We just can't look at them as a subject, if you will. We need to look at them as a whole. And this matter right here, not being able to provide medications and not being able to afford medications is very significant, because the way that I've always looked at this as, you know, we go to medical school, we go through residency, and we know what medications are most efficacious for a certain disorder or disease. And the one that we've been talking a lot about is diabetes. We know that insulin is proven to work very well, especially when our patients reach a certain A1C level. It's not okay that as a practicing physician, our attendings cannot provide that medication for our patients just based on how our pharmaceutical industries are operating. The way that I look at it is, right now, doctors' hands are tied. We know what works for a certain disorder or disease, but we can't provide the medications because our patients can't afford them. That is not okay by any means.
That's Isaiah Cochran with the American Medical Student Association, and Margarita George, Executive Director of the Healthcare for America Now group, and with the Lower Drug Prices Now Coalition. So your job is to try to convince Congress to take on Big Pharma and stop these high prices. That seems like a monumental task.
Yes, it is going to be challenging. But, you know, I think that we are better positioned to do it right now than we have been for a long time for a number of reasons. And these companies are absolutely under scrutiny in a way that they've never been before, right? They have been doing a lot of bad stuff over the years and really not face much public repercussion. This year already we've seen there's been four or five congressional hearings.
Okay, and the last thing that I will add is that we are working and we have been working since 1950. You know, we've been around for nearly 70 years now, and we are have a long history rooted in grassroots activism and advocacy. So this subject, along with many others such as gun safety and universal health care, we are working very hard with our student committees to provide awareness to our medical student members, and then to enable them to reach out to local representatives via, you know, op-eds, letter writing campaigns, and visits. So what our voices as medical students is using our personal experiences on what we've seen in the clinic, and then going to our representatives and speaking to them about it. And that has been very effective for us in many realms, and that's what we will continue to do. And as president here in D.C., I will continue to work and go to the Hill when I am called upon to talk about this, because this is very, very important to us. And we really, really, you know, want our patients to be able to afford the medications that we know work best for them.
All right. Well, Isaiah, thank you so much. And I'll let you drop off, and I'll just hang on. Hope that Margarita rejoins us.
I'm on.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks, Isaiah. Thank you. So, Margarita, let me just restate the question. You've got a big job. You've got to convince Congress to end Big Pharma's control over prices when it comes to health insurance policies and things like Medicare. How do you do it?
Well, I mean, I think that we learned from the experience of passing the Affordable Care Act, and before that from passing Medicaid and Medicare decades ago, that the key to it is really people power, right? The one thing that members of Congress listen to is constituents, and that's true really regardless of who's controlling Congress. Now, that's not to say that we are not going to have to fight our way through a wall of, you know, corporate influence, right? We know that the pharmaceutical lobby has a lot of money, a lot of power. They have more lobbyists than actually members of Congress that are serving. And so, but that's been true for a long time. And that was also true with the insurance industry, right? And we were still able to regulate the insurance industry 10 years ago to stop them from discriminating against people with pre-existing conditions and to expand Medicaid. So I can't echo Isaiah enough. It really does matter when regular people engage and they talk to their members of Congress and they tell members of Congress, we are paying attention on this issue. The reason that prescription drugs is getting so much attention right now is because we all know there's an election coming up, and Democrats and Republicans are going to posture and they're going to make a lot of promises about what they're going to do. But at the end of the day, it doesn't matter what they say. It actually matters what policies they pass. And so our job is to go out there and mobilize millions of people to take action together, like we're doing on the Day of Action tomorrow. and to get people talking to their legislators about this issue so that this debate gets out of the beltway. Right? We don't want it to be just an insular, circular little debate up here between some lobbyists and some congressmen. The fight is going to be out in the states with constituents confronting their elected leaders about why they're letting pharma price gouge and putting medicine further and further out of reach for people of all ages across the country.
And President Trump has promised he's going to come up with a plan that's going to lower drug prices. Has he done that, or do you expect him to do that? And if he hasn't done it, why hasn't it happened?
He hasn't done it. I mean, the president has made a number of different proposals, and the proposals mostly don't deal with drug prices, right? Mostly his proposals address costs, and that's really different than addressing drug prices, right? So there are some things that the country could do to help people better afford their prescription medicine, right? Those are, you know, tweaks that we could make in the system here or there. We've seen prescription drug companies do some of this themselves with the rebates and this and that and that and the other. But that is not the reform that we're looking for, right? The reform that we're looking for isn't about whether we can lower costs this year, because we know that even if we do something to help, you know, old people or kids afford their medicine better this year, in a year, the companies will have raised the prices again and we'll be back to square one. What we need is reform that fundamentally changes the system, that takes away the prescription drug company's power to set these prices so high and then to leverage monopolies and patents to keep them high so that we have no choice because they're the only company that is offering that drug and they can therefore charge whatever they want for it. I don't expect to see very ambitious reform coming out of the administration on this issue. We haven't seen much that's ambitious come out so far. And even the stuff that we've seen come out, President Trump is sort of talking out of both sides of his mouth around some of these issues, right? Just a couple of weeks ago, he proposed allowing drugs from Canada to be imported. Drugs in Canada are cheaper. Importing drugs across the border in order to get people more affordable medicine. Well, you know, okay, but it would be better if we could just fix this problem at home, because importation from Canada is not a solution, it's a workaround. By the way, as he's talking about importing drugs from Canada, at the very same time, we know that he has just negotiated a trade agreement, NAFTA 2.0, that would actually lock in higher drug prices for 10 years. That agreement would raise the cost of prescription drugs in Canada and in Mexico. And so on the one hand, he's saying, let's import from Canada, but really behind the scenes, he's already negotiated a deal, a trade deal with a sweetheart deal for pharma that is going to keep drug prices high and preempt Congress's ability to do much to lower them. So we're coming up on September. There's going to be a lot of debate around NAFTA. He's going to make an announcement about prescription drugs and pre-existing conditions. We'll have an opportunity to evaluate, but my view is anything short of actually taking away these companies' power to increase their profits by gouging patients is not going to be adequate.
And Margarita, if people want to join the coalition or see the coalition's website, what is it?
It's www.lowerdrugpricesnow.org. And if people take a look today and tomorrow, they'll see the map with all the different activities that are going on. And you can click through, find an activity near you, and meet some of your friends and neighbors that are organizing around this issue.
Margarita George, thanks a lot for coming on WMNF.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
That's Margarita George with the new coalition, Lower Drug Prices Now. You can find it at lowerdrugpricesnow.org on the web. And our other guest was Dr. Isaiah Cochran with the American Medical Students Association there at amsa.org. And today is a national day of action for the coalition to lower drug prices now. This is 88.5 FM WMNF in Tampa.
Come back, come back, baby. I've had enough. Oh, a little pain in my heart just won't let me be you. I wake up restless nights. Lord, and I can't even speak.
That's Otis Redding, and you're listening to Radioactivity on WMNF in Tampa. Well, Florida ranks near the bottom of U.S. states when it comes to conserving energy. State law requires that publicly owned utilities and some municipally owned utilities submit 10-year efficiency goals to the Public Service Commission every 5 years. Well, during a Public Service Commission meeting last week in Tallahassee, the state's biggest utilities, both the privately owned ones and the publicly owned ones, argued that they need to do less to conserve energy. Here to talk about that is Susan Glickman, who is the Florida director of the Southern Alliance for Clean Energy. And Susan Glickman, welcome to WMNF. Good to have you here.
Hi, Rob. Thanks for inviting me on.
So you were at the Public Service Commission last week. What were the giant utility companies asking to do or telling the PSC about energy efficiency?
Yes, as you mentioned, every 5 years, the bigger utilities go before the Public Service Commission to set these conservation goals, and they were asking to have goals of zero or near zero. And over the last several proceedings, they've continued to reduce conservation goals, which, of course, is the fastest and cleanest and cheapest way of, you know, meeting our energy needs. So it's really kind of absurd and irresponsible. Florida has the second to worst performance in the Southeast, beating only Alabama. And we rank 36th in the nation for utility programs and policies. That's from our colleagues at the American Council for an Energy Efficient Economy. So Southern Alliance for Clean Energy is an intervener. We are joined also by the organization LULAC, who's intervened as well. So, that's what the utilities come up, and they propose their goals. And then you have the hearing, which is what happened last week, and then the Public Service Commission will come out with those goals, and then the utilities will come back to describe their program plans, and they get those approved.
So they're basically arguing that as much coal as they're burning now or natural gas as they're burning now, they should be able to continue burning that for another decade or so?
Well, that's true, because what's helpful to understand is the way we avoid building new power plants is to capture all the cost-effective efficiencies. So people in the Tampa Bay area were probably paying attention that Tampa Electric wants to build a new gas plant, and the Florida Cabinet just approved that. But if they would capture all the cost-effective energy efficiency, we wouldn't need to do that. But the way the Public Service Commission regulates utilities and Florida law is such that we have a very disjointed utility planning process, and utilities come in and argue in a separate proceeding about why they don't need to capture more efficiency. And essentially their argument is that building codes and appliance standards have made things more efficient, and so there's really no need. The first thing that Florida, and I disagree with that, but the first thing that Florida utilities do when they sit down to set these goals is they deploy a 2-year payback screen. In other words, they eliminate all the cheap stuff from the conversation. So states around the country that are leading, the lion's share of their programs is what Florida eliminates. So if something pays back in less than 2 years, like a water heater blanket, and it's really hundreds of measures, you know, that they eliminate. And one other thing I want to mention, too, is that a lot of people don't realize that the Florida Energy Office is housed in the Florida Department of Agriculture and Consumer Services, which is now led by Democrat Nikki Fried. And they are an automatic party. And I would tell you that in their pre-hearing statement, I was very disappointed that they sided with the utilities and said that their goals were an adequate assessment of what the full technical potential of available, you know, demand-side measures are, and that what the argument becomes about is what cost-benefit test do they use. So they argue to use what they call the rate impact measure, which means does it impact rates? And, of course, if you buy an LED light bulb, it will have a rate impact because it costs money, but yet over the lifetime of that light bulb, it's going to use and save money. So they argued the utilities, and Commissioner Fried in her pre-hearing statement, the Energy Office agreed that the rate impact measure is an adequate test, and we are the only state that uses the rate impact measure. So that's all, in my mind, a lot of sort of gamesmanship, because the utilities fundamentally, their business model is they make more money. You know, the more concrete they put in the ground, the more power plants, they make money selling electricity. So they don't want to help people, use less energy. It's that simple.
Well, is it your opinion that the building codes that are out there in Florida are vastly reducing energy consumption in Florida, so therefore the utility companies don't really have to do their own efficiency measures?
There's some truth to it, but I don't agree with that statement, because there's a lot of energy efficiency that we're leaving off the table. But what happens is it hurts the most vulnerable and those who can least afford it, because more affluent people are becoming more efficient. Every time you get a new refrigerator, washer, dryer, you may put insulation in your home or even get solar for that matter. But it's those who can least afford it, the renters, because in our sort of regulatory landscape, landlords have zero incentive on helping people have more efficient rental homes and apartments, because obviously the tenant pays the electric bill. So things are becoming more efficient. I think it's one of the reasons why a lot of this really seems so egregious, because it falls on the shoulder of people who are lower or middle income and either don't have the information or can't afford these improvements up front.
Well, we're talking with Susan Glickman, who is the Florida director of the Southern Alliance for Clean Energy, and this is WMNF in Tampa. She was one of the people at last week's Public Service Commission meeting in Tallahassee, where four of the seven giant utilities subject to the law about energy efficiency proposed goals of zero energy efficiency for 2020 to 2029. Which seems pretty outrageous, Susan, I got to say. So tell us about the Public Service Commission. Who controls the Public Service Commission in Tallahassee that's going to say yes or no to these utilities?
Yes, and what the utilities are proposing is completely outrageous, and you're totally right about that. The Florida Public Service Commission is a creature of the Florida legislature. It's controlled by the legislature, the budget, you know, is provided by the legislature. There's a legislative nominating committee that decides what names to send up to the governor. The governor does have some responsibility in that, because the governor, when the legislative committee sends names to the governor, they actually pick who is on the commission. And in 2009, when Charlie Crist was governor, there was a more consumer-minded commission, and they moved the needle a little bit. I don't like to give too many numbers, because it can be sort of confusing, but at the time in 2009 and in 2014 and again in 2019, Southern Alliance for Clean Energy was asking that the utilities would save 1% of their retail sales. So just to give you a figure. And at that time, the needle went basically a tenth of a percent. It was a small increase. However, that and standing up to some rate increases cost four public service commissioners their job. So two did not get renominated at the time, and two did not get confirmed by the Senate. And when Rick Scott became governor and four new commissioners were appointed, the first act that they did was to set aside penalties for Florida Power and Light, our biggest utility, and Duke Energy, the second biggest utility, for not meeting their conservation goals. But that Tampa Electric and Gulf Power and the Orlando and Jacksonville utilities did meet their goals and created programs for that. So essentially 2009, half the state did not meet their goals. In 2014, they came to the commission and asked to reduce goals by 99% and 98%, and now they're back asking for zero to near zero goals. So we are just in really bad shape, and in part it is because there are, you know, more efficient appliance standards and so forth, that, you know, really the utilities are making money off the backs of, you know, people who can least afford to do these improvements.
Was there a time when low-income households got some sort of benefit from utility companies to help them reduce their energy consumption?
Well, there were just more programs, you know.
There was a time, yes.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, in 2009, for instance, Duke Energy had a goal. This isn't gigawatt hours, but it was almost 3,500, and now their goal is 165. You know, Florida Power and Light in 2009, it was close to 3,000, and now their goal this year in gigawatt hours is 1. So this is the biggest utility in the state. They're enormously politically powerful. They serve almost 5 million people. They just absorbed a Gulf Power up in the Panhandle. And their goal for the next 5 years is to save the electricity for one home. I mean, it's almost comical. So, it's sort of surprising.
So if the utility companies get their way, will there be any reduction in carbon dioxide from these utilities put into the atmosphere? Is there going to be anything, you know, going towards reduction of global warming?
Well, essentially, no. And they're leaving, you know, the sort of cheap stuff on the table. You know, energy efficiency is really often referred to as the least cost resource because it's the most cost effective tool that we have. So to set that aside, you know, is just really, really irresponsible. And it not only allows you to reduce your energy bill and lower rates, but it helps things like, you know, electric grid constraints and grid reliability. And it also keeps energy dollars right here at home. You know, Florida, because, you know, we don't have gas here and oil here or uranium for nuclear, we bring in all of these sort of energy fuels from elsewhere. So we're sending, you know, $50 billion between transportation and the electric sector out of state every year. So imagine the job creation and economic growth if we would just keep those energy dollars, you know, here at home. And then as the planet warms, you know, people are, you know, needing to use their air conditioner more just to be comfortable and safe and to sleep at night. So you're talking about, you know, public health implications. And if you're having to decide, especially if you're, let's say, a renter and you're in a home where, the you know, you've got the old jalousy windows and there's no insulation, which is a lot of older, you know, housing stock, which we have a great deal of in our region, you know, this is a public health issue. So it's really tragic that, you know, the policymakers, and we need the governor, we need the Florida legislature, to stand up to the utilities, but essentially they don't, because, you know, these big monopoly power companies have enormous political clout. You know, they, for the obvious reasons, they give money to political campaigns, they hire, you know, hundreds of lobbyists, and they contribute to both political parties. So it's really distressing at a time where, you know, the understanding each and every day of the threat of the climate crisis and the warming, you know, it's just becoming more apparent. We're, you know, watching, you know, Greenland and the Arctic sort of melt right before our eyes. And here we are with this low-cost resource, you know, keeping energy dollars here at home, protecting people's public health, creating local jobs, and we're ignoring this. And, you know, people should be standing up and down and screaming about this. But they've been doing it, you know, for years. And to think that we're one of the worst states in the Southeast is really, you know, it's really just tragic.
There are two kinds of utilities in the state of Florida. One, municipally owned utilities like they have in Lakeland and Orlando and Gainesville and Jacksonville. These are nonprofits that help city budgets and county budgets. And then there's the for-profit giants, giants like Duke Energy and Florida Power and Light. Is there any difference? Are the municipally owned utilities more friendly towards energy conservation than are the for-profit giants like Duke and FPNL?
Well, in this particular proceeding, they were not necessarily better. But as you said, so 75% of Florida are covered with these, you know, monopoly investor-owned utilities. And about 15% roughly are the munis. Now, in Orlando, the Orlando Utility Commission, their goal was zero, their proposed goal. And it's, again, I know that local activists over there are, you know, applying pressure to push them along. On the other hand, they do have some programs that other utilities don't. I was just in the mayor's office and sort of listening to this description, and they are offering up to $2,000 for people to help get their homes more efficient because they don't have necessarily the, you know, the goal of being profitable like a, you know, an investor-owned utility would. They tend to be a little more flexible and, you know, have a better attitude about helping consumers because they are controlled by the city. They are owned by those citizens, essentially. So, no, Orlando and Jacksonville both had zero goals. So it's not, you know, it's not necessarily ideal. There's probably a number of reasons for that. There, it's already been announced that the Jackson utility is considering selling, and Florida Power and Light has made clear that they're interested in being a suitor. So there could be some other political pressures that are causing, you know, these munis not to do more in energy efficiency. But Orlando's utility commission has a arrangement where they're, you know, the same principle of looking at life cycle costs also applies to electric buses, for instance. So they're more expensive up front, but over the long haul, they're cheaper. So Orlando is actually buying the battery for the buses and leasing it to the transit authority. And then at the end of the life of that bus, they're going to take it and they're going to use those batteries at emergency centers. So we do see more creative things going on in Orlando, particularly under the leadership of Orlando's Mayor Buddy Dyer. He's been leading on climate and energy issues since 2012, or even since before that. But so it's a little bit of a mixed bag, but nobody showed up well up in Tallahassee and this conservation goal setting. Tampa Electric raised their goal a tiny bit by 14%, but it's half of what they were doing in 2009. Mm. So, you know, they did better, for instance, than FPL did, but it's, you know, not anything to be too excited about.
Susan, one last question. The Public Service Commission met last week. When will they make their decision? And is it too late for people who are concerned about energy conservation to get in touch with the PSC and say, you know, you really ought to require these utilities to pollute less and create more energy conservation programs?
Well, we expect to get the goals to be announced in November. That's when they're set. So it is not too late. And there have been a lot of allied organizations, Southern Alliance for Clean Energy, among them generating letters. We've generated over 3,000 letters collectively to the Florida Public Service Commission. So that is a really terrific thing for people to do. And, you know, don't forget letting your state legislators and also the governor know that this is just not acceptable. But, yeah, there is time. And as I said, the goals will come out in November, so people can contact, you know, the Florida Public Service Commission as well.
Susan, thanks for coming on MNF. Is there anything else you'd like to point out?
Well, I'd just point out the severity of this problem that we're in, you know, and it cannot be okay that we're altering the climate of the planet. So, you know, companies, be they the electric company or be they, you know, ExxonMobil, want to trade in fossil fuels that are just putting us in incredible harm's way. And, you know, energy efficiency is just a simple way to meet our energy needs. And the idea that, you know, we would suggest that a you know, LED light bulb is not cost effective or shouldn't do that because it has some sort of minimal rate impact up front, it's just wholly irresponsible. And, you know, to watch all these policymakers just sort of fall into line when the, you know, ultimate, you know, thing that happens at the end of it all is that we're warming this planet and making for a very inhospitable planet, putting our Gulf Stream in danger. And we could go on, as you know, Rob, for a couple hours on a show on where things are at on climate change. So it just seems utterly ridiculous that utilities would be so irresponsible to keep all this energy efficiency on the table. So I would sort of get mad and reach out to policymakers like Nikki Fried and Governor DeSantis and the Florida Public Service Commission and your legislators.
Susan Glickman, thanks a lot for coming on WMNF.
You bet, Rob. Thank you.
Thank you. Susan Glickman is the Florida director of the Southern Alliance for Clean Energy, and you can find them on the web at SACE.org. And you're listening to WMNF in Tampa. Just parenthetically, this afternoon, the heat index was going to reach 104. Tomorrow, the heat index is going to reach 106. And if you've spent time outdoors, as I have recently, you know that how hot it is at noon or 1 o'clock or 2 o'clock. It seems just abnormally hot out there in this beautiful land that we live in here in Florida. Well, we're going to open up the phone lines and take your phone calls. Our phone number is 813-239-9663. Email address is dj@wmnf.org. There's a few things that we could talk about. We could talk about these two issues, lower drug prices, and also the utility companies saying that they don't really have to set new higher energy efficiency goals. They're fine with the way things are right now. We can talk about that. Our phone number, 813-239-9663. Jan Simpson is our phone producer today. I'll just read a few stories here. The White House is insisting the fundamentals of the economy are strong amid growing concerns that a recession might be in the works. Trump said today's economy is the greatest. While the U.S. is setting records for low unemployment and the economy continues the growth it's enjoyed since Trump took office, the growth is slowing, and stock markets have swung wildly in recent weeks on fears of a recession. Trump is calling on the Federal Reserve to stimulate the economy by cutting interest rates. So that's one story we could talk about. Over in Polk County, seven Puerto Rican healthcare workers say supervisors at their Polk County health clinic warned them to stop speaking Spanish among themselves or they would get fired. Women work at the Florida Health Department clinic in Haines City. The community group La Mesa Boricua de Florida says the group filed a human resources complaint and wrote a letter to the Florida Department of Health. And again, our phone number is 813-239-9663. As you may have heard, Florida's iconic palm trees are under attack from a fatal disease that turns them to dried crisps within months with no chance for recovery once they get sick. The disease is called lethal bronzing. It's caused by a bacteria that's spread by a tiny insect. It's gone from a small infestation here on Florida's Gulf Coast to a statewide problem in a decade. And again, our phone number is 813-239-9663. You can email your comment into the studio here at dj@wmnf.org. And here's a call from Doug in Clearwater. Doug, what would you like to talk about today?
Rob, hey, great show, but really, is Florida going to give Nestle 100 million gallons of water a day?
No, I think it's a million gallons of water a day.
I mean, my bad. I overdid that one.
Yeah, so Sean reported yesterday on the MNF News that Nestle's the giant Nestle Food Corporation is near the Santa Fe River, just a few miles outside of Gainesville, and it wants to. It has a permit, and it wants to use that permit to pump about a million gallons, maybe more, of water from the aquifer every day, and then bottle it and then sell it to consumers around the state and around the world. What do you think?
Maybe my only question is, how do any of your listeners support that? Because I can tell you, I don't. I don't know why that would even be an option that anybody would consider. From the Nestle Corporation to the state of Florida, why? How does that work? I don't know.
I bet if you were to take a poll of our listeners, first of all, many would not know about it. Two is that I'm sure they would ask the question, why would any company be allowed to take the precious, pristine Florida aquifer, put a straw in there that's a giant straw, suck it out, and then bottle it, and then sell it at a huge profit, and not give any money back to Florida and draw down the aquifer? I think a lot of listeners would ask that question. Why would the authorities here in the state of Florida allow that to happen? I think that we have a lot of environmentalists in our audience.
I would suggest, I wish everybody had a chance to go see how beautiful those waters are. And then they would have an opinion if they don't already.
Yeah, Doug, don't you think it's a shame? Yeah, don't you think it's a shame that no other radio station really talks about it except for WMNF?
Oh, no.
There's 53 radio stations here in the Tampa Bay area, and almost no other radio station devotes any time to talking about the environment of Florida. And certainly not, if they do it, they do it in snippets. They'll do it in a 2-minute snippet or a 3-minute snippet or a 40-second snippet. Here at MNF, we spend a lot of time talking about it. And I hope you appreciate that, Doug.
I do. I got rid of cable because I didn't want to listen to the news anymore. The only news I hear is through your station, and I love it. It just also disappoints me about what you have to report on.
All right, Doug, thanks a lot. Thank you.
Thank you, Rob.
All right, good to hear from you. Let's go to Andy in Sarasota. Andy, you're on WMNF. Thank you for calling in.
Hi, Rob. In answer to the caller's question about, you know, how somebody, you know, as repulsive as Nestle, the CEO of Nestle has declared that, you know, human beings have no essential right to clean water that can all be privatized. Florida statute holds, and in fact, it might even be the Florida Constitution, but Florida law, let's just say, holds that the waters of the state belong to everybody. Now, what that means is they belong to you, and they also belong to Mosaic, and they also belong to Nestle. And so while you and I can't do any more than take a, you know, 100, 200 gallons a day, an outfit like Nestle or Mosaic gets its $64 million, million gallon a day allotment of water stone-free. And so Nestle will get theirs stone-free, too, and it's all legal. So I just wanted to put that in there.
And isn't that an argument for the legislature and the governor to step in and say no?
Yeah, you'd think. I mean, you know, every developer, every rapacious, greedy developer, every, you know, big corporation gets to draw down as much of the aquifer as they can. The aquifer is visibly getting lower. That draws in salt water from the perimeter, from the coast. Then the heavily developed coast is going to be forced, it already is happening, to go to these municipal, industrial-sized reverse osmosis. And the cost of water at the tap will be four times what it is right now.
And do you think the legislature is even going to take a step to preserve the aquifer this year?
we were watching all these guys, you know, get up there and stand next to Michael Crosby at Moat Marine Labs and you know, get anointed by the scientific gods. And we're going to go up there and we're going to cure the algae problem, the nutrient pollution. They did nothing. They're not going to do anything about this either. The politics are just too lethal. They all take too much money from the developers. You know, it goes right down to money and politics. You know, yeah, boring, boring, boring. But that's what it is, you know. Citizens United, money and politics, and the rest of us are screwed.
All right, Andy, thanks a lot. Thank you.
Thanks for taking the call, Rob.
Yeah, at least there's one radio station where you can talk about this. You're listening to 88.5 FM, and let's go to Nancy in St. Pete. Nancy, thank you for calling.
Hi.
Hi.
Hey. Okay. Yeah. Well, Zephyr Hills Water. Who owns it now? I mean, did Nestle ever own it? I know that Perrier owned it at one time. I believe it was Coca-Cola or PepsiCo that owned it at one time. And it's been, you know, I don't know how many years that they've been drawing down on our aquifer for Zephyr Hills Water, man. And, you know, you've seen the ad. Well, there's no hills in Zephyr Hills. Well, there are, but the water sure is good, you know. And that goes way back.
As yeah, you know, and you're right. Nestle's did buy Zephyr Hills. Yeah,
it did. Yeah. And so there you are, because they already have a foot in the door. You know, anything that anybody's going to say now, they're going to say, well, we've been doing it all this time. You know, I years ago, I called into WMNF and said, how can they do that? I mean, I'm talking 20, 30 years ago, man.
Yeah, because we covered the effort by some people that were in North Hillsborough County to try to stop Zephyr Hills from sucking water out of the Crystal Springs. And we covered that issue for years here at WMNF. And in the end, the giant corporations won.
I know. Well, you can thank people like Claude Kirk for that. Because, man, that was his whole thing, was getting developers down here without any kind of corporate income tax and, I mean, anything to get people to come to Florida to, you know, waste it for profit.
All right,
listen,
Nancy.
I gotta go, but
thanks
thank
a lot,
so
Nancy. All right.
Call.
All right. Good to hear from you. If you want to comment about today's show, please call us up at 813-238-8001. Record your comment on extension 115. And we'll play your comments back tomorrow morning at 11 o'clock. Your hero, Mark Biro, is coming up in the next hour on the Midpoint program. Jan Simpson's been our phone producer today. I'm Rob Lori. Thanks for listening. This is 88.5 FM, WMNF, Tampa, St. Petersburg, the Bay Area's community radio station. And in just a moment, we're going to get the latest news from National Public Radio.